Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. According to the biblical account, the Ark of the Covenant held the stone tablets that bore the Ten Commandments. The Ark disappeared from the temple in Jerusalem when the Babylonians invaded in the year 586 BC, and it was lost, apparently, forever. However, over the last 2,000 years or so, many scholars and archaeologists and treasure hunters have claimed to know what happened to the Ark. And this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk with someone who believes he has some answers to this rather intriguing question, one of the most, some people would say, and one of the most enduring and interesting mysteries in all of archaeology. Our guest is Tudor Parfitt. He is a professor of Jewish studies at London's School of Oriental and African Studies. He is also fellow of the Oxford Center of Hebrew and Jewish Studies and has written widely on the history of the Jews of Africa and Asia. He is the author of a recently published book that we will talk about. The title is The Lost Ark of the Covenant, Solving the 2,500-Year-Old Mystery of the Fabled Biblical Ark. It's published by Harper One, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of the people who call in is that they try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Parfitt, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a great pleasure.
Just remind us, for anyone who might have now forgotten their Bible history, what it is that we are talking about. Describe this object.
Well, I guess most people know of the Ark of the Covenant as a result either of their Bible reading or as a result of their film watching. It's the thing that Indiana Jones famously managed to snatch away, if I understand it correctly, from the clutches of the Nazis. And, of course, it figures very prominently in a good deal of the Old Testament. It was initially a rather simple object, like a carrying case, if you wish, for the Ten Commandments that were inscribed on two stone tablets. And Moses was commanded by God to make a carrying case for these things to be taken down from Mount Sinai. And he was instructed to build it out of the only wood that he would have found in that vicinity, which is a kind of desert acacia. And presumably he, if we are to believe this biblical account, it would have been a fairly rough and ready thing because he did it on the mountain with whatever tools he had stuck in his belt.
And now I guess the image that people will have, again, whether that's they have read the description in Scripture, or they are simply going from Indiana Jones, this was a fairly good-sized box. It had rings on the side through which poles were inserted so that it could be carried, and it had the figures of two angels on the top facing one another, and it was said also to be covered with gold.
Yes. Now, there are two... There are two different descriptions in the Bible. One is in the book of Deuteronomy, which is the account that I have just given. Moses made it himself out of wood. We don't hear of him adding gold and cherubim to the object at this point. And then there is another account in the book of Exodus, which is much more elaborate. Of course, the book of Exodus, like indeed the book of Deuteronomy, written very, very much after the event. And my sense is that the elaborate description was a way of making the rather bizarre and sui generis ark fit into the pattern of analogous, similar objects in the Middle East some hundreds of years later. Mm-hmm. Because it was commonplace in the Middle East for God to be presented in precisely the way and the god, whether it be Egyptian, Hittite, or Assyrian, would sit in the middle of these two monsters. And that was current practice. That's how you presented your god. And the Ark of the Covenant, as it's described in Exodus, looks very much like one of these things, with the sole exception that there was an empty gap between the two monsters, because, of course, the god of the Jews, the god of the Israelites, was invisible. He was not something that could be seen. And one has to remember that the men who wrote the text had never seen the Ark, yes, and so our only kind of way of being able to really reconstruct what it was is to read very, very carefully in between the lines of the text. And if we do that, then a somewhat slightly different object appears, which is quite specific to the Jews, and specific to the desert, and specific to their own experience as runaway slaves.
Apparently, there are some people who think that there could have been more than one. Could it have been the case that, indeed, if as the story is told, that Moses himself made this very rough box out of the available wood that was there, so that the pieces, the broken pieces of the tablets that had the commandments chiseled onto them, so that he could have some way to keep them and carry them? Could it have been that? Also, could it have been that later, when they were more settled and had access to other kinds of materials, someone could have made another one, and that it actually could have looked like this description?
Yes, I think it's possible, although I would come back to the point that the people who wrote the text and did the description had never seen it, so they couldn't know what it looked like by definition. And I think that, you know, what they described was the kind of, you know, it was the most glorious similar object that may have been seen on the streets of, you know, the great neighboring countries, and particularly Egypt, the sort of thing that you would see, you know, around the temples of Thebes, for instance, people carrying, you know, things on poles, and they'd be covered in gold, and they would have these kind of winged objects on them. So as they tried to instill dignity, beauty, importance, reverence into their description and understanding of the Ark, that's, you know, they presented it in the most impressive way that they could, drawing on parallels of their own time.
So so what you're suggesting then is that the object, that if one was looking for it, and one was simply going by that description, the one that people have read, the thing that perhaps they have in their mind, that if you happen to have come across the actual object, you might walk right by it, because what it would be a very relatively simple, plain, and by this time fairly worn wooden container of some sort.
That's more or less what I'm saying. And you see, the other part of it is, well, okay, Moses first of all makes his container. Very soon, it's carried around on poles. This is, I'm sure, true. And it's used as a kind of weapon. Its function is to instill fear into the heart of the enemy. It's taken before the troops at a very good distance from the troops. Nobody is allowed to see it. It's only the priests who are allowed to see it. And it does indeed tend, not always, but usually tend to guarantee victory. And, of course, it was used in the destruction, the famous destruction of the walls of Jericho, which came tumbling down. And it was used to blitz away through the River Jordan. And subsequently it was used with you know, moderate or at least mixed success against the Philistines. But on an individual basis, it was clear that, you know, people who touched it, who shouldn't touch it, or approached it in the wrong way, would be killed or were killed as a result of fire coming out of it. And, you know, I think reading the text, and, you know, if one is to believe the text as being at least in part a historical text, and let us be in no doubt about the historicity of a good deal of the Bible and its detractors, really, exaggerate rather dreadfully, the ahistoricity of the Bible. There's a good deal in the Bible which is good history. I mean, just think of, the way in which the great hero David is described, in his shenanigans with Bathsheba on the rooftop and so on. Even the warts were described in this history. It's good history for the most part, and the description of the ark and what it did, I think, is likely to be good history. Now, we don't understand what the men of the Old Testament thought about things. We don't understand what they did with their lives. It's too far away, and we have very, very limited information in the Bible, unfortunately, and a good deal of the text that might have given us more information have been lost. So we don't really know what they were at, and we certainly don't know what kind of technologies the priests might have had at their disposal, which possibly they may have learned in Egypt before they crossed into the Sinai.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 582 to Parfit is professor of Jewish Studies at London's School of Oriental and African Studies. He's also a fellow of the Oxford Center of Hebrew and Jewish Studies and has written widely on the history of the Jews in Africa and Asia. And he is the author of The Lost Ark of the Covenant, Solving the 2,500-Year-Old Mystery of the Fabled Biblical Ark. It's published by Harper One, which is a division of HarperCollins. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Why is it, maybe you could answer this question for yourself or for others who have shared this interest, why is it that this particular object is so compelling?
Well, it's so compelling because, it was multifunctional in terms of the way that we understand it in the Bible. One of its features was that it was seen as being almost an embodiment of God, certainly the dwelling place of God. The top of it was considered to be the footstool of the Almighty. So for the Jews, it was quite the most important thing in their lives, and the Temple of Jerusalem was constructed by King Solomon to house it. And, for our time and our generation, Christians throughout the world, of course, know of it from their Bible reading. They know of its sanctity in the ancient world. And, of course, its disappearance in 586 BC has never been explained. It's one of the great unsolved mystery of our Western world.
Mm-hmm. When was the last time now, or what were the circumstances when it could be established where, in fact, it was? When the last time anyone knew where exactly it was?
Well, according to the Bible, we know that it was in the temple in Jerusalem shortly before the arrival of the Babylonians. The story in Raiders of the Lost Ark was a bit not very historical or well researched in a way, because the claim there was that it was taken away in the 9th century to Egypt, but we know very well from the biblical text that it was still in Jerusalem at that time. And the question is, what happened? The priests who looked after it knew full well that the Babylonians were marching noisily towards Jerusalem. They had plenty of warning of their impending arrival. And you have to ask yourself, what would they have done? Would they have left it there to fall into the hands of the enemy and to be carted back in triumph to Babylon, or would they have taken it somewhere and hidden it? And I believe that they took it out of Jerusalem and hid it.
Well, that does seem to be the most reasonable kind of assumption, that, as you say, that if you knew that your city was about to be taken by a foreign power, and you had this thing that was the most sacred, most important object that you had, you would do whatever you could to make sure that this didn't fall into the hands of the enemy.
Yes, I think that's right. And, there are two rather conflicting Jewish traditions. One is that it was hidden under the area that contained the wood store of the temple, the place where the wood used for the burnt sacrifices was kept. That's not very credible in the sense that the whole of the temple was destroyed, and it would presumably have been discovered during the destruction of the temple. And had it been discovered, we would know about it. We would know about it because the Jews that they would have inscribed upon their cuneiform tablets, their delight at having captured this important object. So there's none of this. The assumption, therefore, is that it wasn't hidden in the temple and that it was hidden somewhere else. And there have been various theories as to where it might have been taken. And in my book, I travel the world following the clues both in the Bible and in post-biblical literature and in quite a lot of Arabic literature as well. And we look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, particularly the Copper Scroll. And this kind of study of mine over many years finally led me to place reliance upon the Book of Maccabees, which suggests that the prophet Jeremiah took the ark and hid it in a cave on Mount Nebo in Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan River. And this was the mountain from which Moses had been permitted to gaze upon the promised land, which, of course, he never set foot in.
Hmm. What leads you to that particular place?
Well, it seems to, it's the only biblical reference, it's the only biblical suggestion as to what happened to it, really. And so if one is to take the only sort of history which is at our disposal, then in a way one would have to say, well, maybe this is, this is what happened. The time is right. It's before the Babylonians get there that this is supposed to have happened. And, of course, the text is written sometime afterwards, but, it may very well rely upon a more ancient written source that was lost or upon, closely guarded oral tradition. In any event, this particular idea, this particular explanation was incorporated into a lot of Arabic texts subsequently, which suggested that the Ark was alive and well in Arabia at a later time. And there are some very, very precise and detailed accounts of where it was and what it was doing in these Arabic sources, down to listing names of Yemeni families over many generations who guarded the Ark. Now, all of this is completely new stuff, really, in the world of Ark of the Covenant studies. Mm. And, it's quite interesting. It kind of gives a new history of the Ark over a period of 1,000 years. And it's dependent upon very, very ancient written traditions and eyewitnesses to its activity.
As you say, that over time there have been a number of people who have said that they knew where it was. There is, in fact, today a church in Ethiopia where they, in fact, say they have it, although they won't let anybody see it. They say that it's there. You ended up in Zimbabwe talking with some people who also have in their tradition that they had it, or at least your attention focused on a particular sacred object of theirs. Now, I think the thing that I think about is when you take a look at the, pull out your atlas and take a look at the map, Zimbabwe is a long way away from the Middle East. That would be a very long walk. How does one suppose that if indeed this is this object that we're talking about, is the Ark, that it got all the way from the Middle East down into southern Africa?
Could I ask you a question? How far do you travel in to work in the morning?
It's about a mile and a half.
So that wouldn't be a very good example. I kind of commute between France and London.
Yes, my commute is a little shorter.
Yeah, it is.
Now, I walk it myself.
I take an aeroplane, and you might think that, from Montpellier to London is an impossibly long trip, but no, it's not, because there's an aeroplane. And in the case of, the connections between the Middle East and the east coast of Africa, they were served by the absolute kind of superhighway of their day. a particular piece of coastline which benefited from the from winds which half the year pushed boats down the south, and then the second half of the year they these monsoon winds they pushed the boat back. So from the place from which I'm suggesting the priest took the ark, and I have some quite interesting evidence for that. It's 10 days or so of easy sailing with winds behind you, and then you're in the great port of Sofala, which had disappeared, but in the ancient world it was an important port on the coast of Mozambique, what is today Mozambique, which was visited by Indian boats, ships, probably Chinese junks, and it was an important place that people could get to. The idea that the ark is in Aksum is bereft of any evidence at all. The first rather unenthusiastic reference to the ark being there dates only to the 14th century, and we do actually have an eyewitness in the form of a very significant scholar of Ethiopian studies who saw the thing in the 1940s and maintains that it was new and of no historical importance. Now, the man in question is one of the great Ethiopian scholars of the 20th century. If anybody would know, it would be him. Nobody really in the academic world attaches any importance other than the importance of myth to the Ethiopian accounts. It's not a historical. It's not a historical narrative, if you like.
Our guest in this hour, Tudor Parfitt, he's professor of Jewish studies at London School of Oriental and African Studies. He's also fellow of the Oxford Center of Hebrew and Jewish Studies. He's written widely on the history of the Jews in Africa and Asia. In 2006, he was appointed distinguished visiting fellow at Harvard University, has traveled widely through remote areas of Africa and Asia, and he is the author of the recently published book, The Lost Ark of the Covenant, the subtitle Solving the 25-Year-Old Mystery of the Fabled Biblical Ark, and it's published by Harper One, which is a division of HarperCollins. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, is there reason then to make some kind of connection, and I know that there is reason to make that connection, between these people, the Lemba, who live in Zimbabwe, and the people of the ancient Middle East?
Well, I myself did it. I happened to be in Ethiopia and at the time of the Great Famine back in the 1980s. And subsequently, I wrote a book on the escape of the Ethiopian Jews, the Falashas, to Israel. It was called Operation Moses, a long time ago. And I was subsequently invited to go and give a talk at one of the universities in South Africa, where a group of black people at the back of the hall where I was talking attracted my attention. They were wearing Jewish yarmulkes. And they told me that they were members of the Lemba tribe, and they claimed to be of Jewish origin and to have come to South Central Africa hundreds of years before. Now, I was intrigued by their stories and spent quite a number of months collecting material for a book about this tribe, and I lived with them in their grass huts in central Zimbabwe. Nobody in the world believed what they had to say about themselves. Nobody believed that they came from the Middle East. They looked African. Their habits and customs appeared to be African. The language that they spoke was one of the Bantu languages. Nobody believed that they were, Jewish in any way, particularly Jews. So, anyway, I kind of did my research. I could see that they had lots of Semitic customs which seemed to connect them to the Middle East in some way, but I wasn't able to find any kind of definitive proof, no smoking gun to show that they really had indeed come from the Middle East or from Israel. Until I thought at one point that it would be interesting to do some genetic study on the group, and along with a group of world-famous geneticists, we produced a couple of articles which demonstrated, A, that they had come from Israel, that they had come from the Middle East, and that their Y chromosome, that the men, you know, the men came from the Middle East, passed down the Y chromosome, which has kind of got Middle Eastern elements on it. The second thing was that a priestly tribe of this Lemba tribe, a priestly clan, if you like, called the Buba, who were the guardians of the object which I subsequently discovered and which they maintained was the Ark of the Covenant, this subgroup had a particular genetic signature, a haplotype, which is characteristic of people bearing the name Kohen, which means priest in Hebrew, and the general assumption has been that Kohanim are directly descended from the priests who officiated in the temple in Jerusalem. And geneticists have been able to show that people called Kohanim, who believe themselves to be in a priestly line, along with the priestly group of this Central African tribe, can be traced back to a common ancestor who lived about 3,000 years ago somewhere in the Middle East. Now that is hard science, if you like. And, you know, once these things had been established, it was necessary for me to regard their oral traditions with even greater respect than I had before, and particularly in view of little details. I mean, one of the things that they said about themselves, when they arrived in Africa, they came in a boat from a place called Sena. They didn't know where this was, but they'd remembered that they'd come from Sena somewhere, come in a boat, and that when they got to the African shore, there were seven of them. And the geneticists doing the studies were able to show that the founding group in Africa were seven men who'd come from the Middle East. Now, another part of their oral tradition then, and this is a critical part of my book on my discovery of the Ark of the Covenant, was that they brought the Ark from Arabia by sea, and that at some point, they don't have a date, we're not talking about very sophisticated people here by and large, although they were a good deal more sophisticated than many other groups in the area. They claim that it self-destructed in some way, that it was in the compound of the king, they always say. It was protected by lions, by snakes. It was a magical object. And then all of a sudden there was a great noise, fire and smoke poured out of the compound and out of the ark, and it was destroyed. And at that point, the priests took a little of the destroyed ark and used this as the basis, or as a core, if you like, for constructing a new one along the same pattern. And that one had the same powers, according to the oral tradition, as the predecessor. And they kept that for some time, and there are many stories about what it did, how it was successful at leading the troops into battle, the things that it did, the people that it killed, the holiness that emanated from it, its qualities of sanctity, and so on. And then it was lost. And they said, well, you know, this was a long time ago. One person recorded some years ago that it was lost in 1600, which was a very, very roundabout figure. Nobody, you know, with these oral traditions can really trace back dates very successfully. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it's 100 years old. And when finally I was able to track it down, it had been hidden in a cave and probably had stayed in that cave for hundreds of years. And anyway, I was able to track it down to a storeroom in Harare, which is the capital of Zimbabwe, and we radiocarbon dated the object, and it turns out to go back to 1300 or so, and that makes it the oldest wooden object in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa that we know about. The oldest wooden object in the British Museum, which is arguably the best museum in the world, their oldest object is just over 100 years old. So, you know, this is quite... many of its aspects to be entirely true. So I think we have to look at the story and look at the discovery with a certain degree of respect.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, again, Tudor Parfit. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. We have a caller to take, and let us do that. Someone listening in Rensselaer, Indiana, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
You said earlier that the Ark was used to intimidate enemies, and particularly was used in the destruction of Jericho. I thought Jane Kenyon had shown that Jericho had long since been destroyed before it was estimated that the Hebrews crossed into that area. Was Jericho standing when Joshua and his armies came into that part of the Middle East?
Well, I remember Kathleen Kenyon making this point. It's not really critical in a sense. Because even if that bit of the story is not, utterly historical, I mean, what we're talking about here is the most ancient history for the people who wrote the historical parts of the Bible, and whether it's Jericho or whether it's some other place, the critical thing really here is that, according to their beliefs, the Ark did remarkable things as they crossed into Palestine, as they crossed into Canaan. And Jericho was the obvious place for anybody to attack. And that's the place through which they came, according to these old strata of their history. And whether it's precisely as it's recounted in the Bible or not, I don't really think should worry us too much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. And again, our guest is Tudor Parfit. He's professor of Jewish Studies at London School of Oriental and African Studies and fellow of the Oxford Center of Hebrew and Jewish Studies, and is author of the recently published book, The Lost Ark of the Covenant, Solving the 2,500-Year-Old Mystery of the Fabled Biblical Ark, published by Harper One. It's a division of HarperCollins. Well, just so we have here this people, the Lemba, people who live in Zimbabwe, who have within their history the story that some of them at least came there a long way by boat from some place that now we can place in Yemen, I guess, that they would have come there. Their story is that they came from a long way away. They had this object that sounds in many ways like the Ark was described. It was used in the same ways that the Ark was described. So for them, this was an important sacred object, the Ngoma, they call it. And it was lost. Now, first of all, you believe that then this object that you found stored away with a lot of other stuff in Harare, so you actually believe that is that, whether it's the Ark or not, you think that is in fact the Ngoma?
Yes, there's little doubt that it's the Ngoma, because the Ngoma was actually found just after the Second World War in the 1940s. By a missionary who'd been living and working with the Lemba in Zimbabwe for many, many years. And he was familiar with these oral traditions that I've been talking about, and subsequently wrote a book in German that was published in Uppsala a few years later. And, he was much closer to, because, he'd started his work in the 1920s, so he's much, much closer to the traditions than I was when I started my field work in the 1980s. What's happening in Africa is that all of these ancient traditions are being lost as, the population is getting more sophisticated and so on. So, he wrote his book, and he included in the book a couple of photographs, black and white photographs, of the object that he had found in the cave in the Limpopo Valley, and it was because of the photographs that I was able to be absolutely certain that what I had found was what he had found in the cave, and the subsequent carbon dating confirms that it's extremely old. I mean, that's all it does. It confirms that it's very, very old. But for von Sicard, who, as I said, was closer to the traditions than I am, there was no doubt in his mind, nor in the mind of the members of the Lemba tribe, who knew about his discovery, and apparently it was buried, rather it was hidden in a cave, along with the bones of someone that the Lemba believed to have been a priest who was there looking after it.
Mm-hmm. And what was the Lemba story about where this object came from?
The basic story that the Lemba had, but they didn't really fully understand the story, they just had the story, was that they had left somewhere called Sena, crossed something called Pusela, and they didn't know what Pusela was, and they didn't know what Sena was, until finally they got to Africa. They were in a boat, and originally there were 14 people. Seven went north, and seven came south. And the seven that came south are the ones that brought the ark with them into Central Africa. Mm.
So they brought it with them, and in their tradition, though, do they say that's what this is?
They it's not what they called it in the. In the languages that they learnt in Africa, they speak either Shona or Venda or other languages, depending upon which tribe they're associated with. They believe that they once had a language of their own, but there's no living speaker of that language, and it's very difficult to know what that language could have been anyway. Although there are one or two words that. Quite interesting, but I haven't been able to come up with anything particular on that.
Now, you said that you had done radiocarbon dating on this, so you know that it's old. Is it in fact acacia? What kind of wood is it?
I don't believe it is, and I don't believe that it needs to be, because all I'm saying is that. That I've discovered a very ancient object which is embedded in an ancient history. The ancient history says that they brought the ark or something which they call these days the ark, because now they speak English, from somewhere called Sena, and they brought it to Africa, and when it got to Africa, it auto-destructed. And then they built a new one. I believe that what I found is the new one. And even though acacia is a common enough African tree, there's absolutely no reason why the priests would have felt constrained to build their new ark out of this wood. They were not familiar with that tradition. In fact, it's built, according to an expert at the British Museum, out of a fig tree, which is quite interesting because in the places that they live, which is to say in the high belt areas mainly of South Africa or Zimbabwe, in other words, fairly high up and reasonably temperate, you don't find these trees there lowland. So it was presumably something that was built... closer to the coast, and perhaps soon after their arrival in Africa.
Then, what I guess I'm what I'm a little bit confused about is then if this is a new object, a newer object that's obviously old. What of the and if indeed the Lemba, the people did come and they did bring the ark, and something happened to it. And then they used part of it in this new object. I guess I'm confused about what of the old object, what of the original ark, if in fact it was there, is there in this new object, is in the Ngoma?
Well, I'm reliant in this, and it's obviously a very good question, and I'm reliant as I am with respect to all aspects of this story, on the oral narrative. And according to the oral narrative, they used a bit of the original thing, and that was the core of the new one, and it had all of the powers and attributes of its predecessor. Looking at the object I found, indeed, there is a very round and deliberate hole at the base of the object, and I believe that that would have been plugged at one point, you know, originally with a piece of the old. But we're talking about something which is very, very dilapidated, and which clearly has had an adventurous life, because part of it is completely worn away, another part of it has been burnt. It's covered with very distinct burn marks. And if anybody saw the History Channel documentary last night in the United States, they would have seen the burn marks, which are quite apparent.
And I did, forgive me, I had indeed intended to mention this, that that this object, your search, this story, is indeed the subject of a documentary that aired, has now aired a couple of times on the History Channel. It aired last night, and I don't know if it's going to air again. I would expect that people could go to their website, the History Channel website, and look at their broadcast schedule. Do you know, will the show run
Yes,
again?
I believe so. I haven't got times, but I understand that it's going to be showing regularly over the next few days anyway.
All right. Well, certainly people can consult their television listings. They can go to the History Channel website, I'm sure. Also, if you'd like, you can go to the bookstore and read the book that we're talking about, The Lost Ark of the Covenant, by our guest Tudor Parfit, and we have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of the show. Well, it seems that you have found an object, this object that the Lemba call the Ngoma. There doesn't seem to be too much doubt about that. So what you have found here is certainly something that to this group of people in Zimbabwe was very important, and to whom they attach this kind of history. So I suppose then the ultimate question, and it's one I'm sure that you have confronted and you confronted in the book, is past that, past the fact that indeed it seems that you have found this object of the Lemba, the Ngoma, what have you found? What is this?
I think that, you see, one has to stick with the idea that Tudor Parfit has found an object which is embedded in a tradition. Now, if I were to say to you, I found these ancient manuscripts which describe how Jonathan the priest brought the object to Africa, I think you'd be quite impressed. And I think most people would say, wow, we've got this ancient manuscript and we can, we can date this because of its calligraphy or whatever. And we can even perhaps radiocarbon date paper or something of the sort. Now, I don't have that. What I have is an oral tradition. And what I'm saying is that in so many aspects, the oral tradition of these people has proved to be very, very accurate. So, yes, they came from the Middle East. Yes, the priestly caste, whose job it was to look after the Ngoma, is almost certainly consists of descendants of priests. That seems to be entirely probable. And if we're going to, if we're going to believe that, it's not difficult to believe those two things because we've got good scientific support for it, and it's not very difficult to believe the rest of their narrative, which is that they brought this object from originally from Israel, and they brought it to Africa, and it is indeed a descendant of the original Ark. Hmm.
So where is the Ngoma now?
Let me just finish the thought there.
Oh, sure.
In a sense, what we haven't discussed is the way in which, and I must compliment you on your excellent questioning. You're giving me a very rigorous interrogation here, and I appreciate that very much. I think we have to look at the kind of phenomenology of the two things, and if you compare what the Ngoma is doing with what the Ark was alleged to have done, very, very close, if not identical. They look very similar, and they're doing the same things. And there is this tradition which connects it with Senna, and I've managed to locate Senna to the satisfaction, I think, of most people in the eastern end of the Hadhramout in the Yemen. And where is it now? It's, well, when the missionary we were speaking of discovered it in the 1940s, he quite promptly put it in a museum in what was then the Rhodesian second city of Bulawayo. And when I started getting interested in this object, of course, the first thing I did was to go to Bulawayo to try and find it, and I failed. It had disappeared. It was not to be found, and nobody in the museum had the foggiest idea what had happened to it. And I was later able to reconstruct that during the Civil War between the white colonists and the local population, it had been taken for safekeeping to the capital, which then was Salisbury, now it's called Harare, and it was placed in the storeroom of one of the Harare museums, along with a lot of other ethnographic stuff, some of which is quite interesting, but there's nothing of any great significance, and nobody in the museum had the slightest sense of what this thing was, what it was doing, where it was from, or anything of the sort.
Well, it's there's a photograph of the Ngoma here, the object in the book, and it is it's difficult to tell from the photograph how big it is. It looks like some kind of large wooden bowl, perhaps. It's rather seriously damaged. It has a large hole in it, as you describe. It looks like it's been exposed to fire. It has an interesting carving pattern on the side. So I suppose that one might look at it and say, well, that's a kind of interesting object. But also I suppose one might pass right by it. Even if it was in a display case in a museum, you might stand there for a couple of minutes and look at it and think, well, that's interesting, and then go on. There doesn't seem to be very, very much about it that in and of itself, although I'm not an archaeologist, that would draw your eye to it and say, wait a minute, I think this here thing is something that's very important.
No, I think you need to know the something of the oral history of the Lemba to appreciate what the pattern on the side is, and you have to look very carefully at it to perceive the remains of the carrying rings. It was clearly carried on poles. Mm-hmm. And it's the narrative which is interesting. The narrative which says, well, this thing goes in front of the troops into battle. This thing is never allowed to touch the ground. If you touch this thing, you are dead. The only people who are allowed to touch this thing are the priests. There were sacred things embedded in this thing. This thing is the mouthpiece of God. Everything that you can say about the Ark, from its functionality to its other characteristics, you will find reflected in the Lemba narrative. And it doesn't seem to me to require a huge stretching of the imagination to sense that this is really the last object on the face of the earth, direct descent from the Ark of the Temple.
Given that around the world there have been demands from indigenous people for the return of sacred objects that are in museums, one might think that the Lemba might decide that they should have this back.
Oh, I'm sure that they know, actually, because as part of the History Channel film, we told them and showed them a bit of movie of the Ngoma that we discovered, and they were, of course, very excited. And then, in the film, there are certain reactions to its discovery on the part of Lemba elders who do believe that it's the Ark of the Covenant, and undoubtedly they will be wanting to get their hands on it. But as it also forms part of the tradition of the tribes with which the Lemba at one time were associated, because the Lemba was sort of the magicians and the doctors and the they'll be after it. Everybody will be after it.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. If you would like to read this story, you go to the bookstore and look for The Lost Ark of the Covenant by our guest Tudor Parfitt. It's published by Harper One, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. Also, you can check the listings for the History Channel. It's the subject of a documentary that aired at its premiere last night on the History Channel and will be shown again, so you can look for that. Our guest Tudor Parfitt is professor of Jewish Studies at London's School of Oriental and African Studies and also a fellow of the Oxford Center of Hebrew and Jewish Studies. He's written widely on the history of the Jews in Africa and Asia. Professor Parfitt, thank you very much.
Thank you.